Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Progressively Incorrect. I am your host, Zach Groeschel, and I am so excited today to be talking to Femi Adeniran all the way across the pond in the UK, all about math teaching, and as he will call it, maths teaching, I'm sure. And before we kind of dive into how does a great math lesson look when using direct instruction, and how do we coach departments of math teachers to sort of row in the same direction? Let's talk about our sponsors. As you know, John Catt from Hachette Learning is one of the sponsors of this podcast, and I wrote a book for them, Just Tell Them, The Power of Explanations and Explicit Teaching, and I have the whole catalog for you to check out. They have lots and lots of evidence-informed books. Check out those books in the show notes. And you may also know that I'm the director of StepLab North America, and we have a lot of events coming up. So if you want to check out the show notes, I have our upcoming event in New York City, for example. It's an in-person event, and our online programs that are for training instructional coaches and instructional leaders. Go ahead and check that out, and the demo link is there as well. I'm excited for you to get into the world of StepLab. Femi, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It is great to have you on.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to come full circle too, because one of my favorite episodes I've ever recorded with anyone was for your Beyond Good podcast. Maybe tell listeners a little bit about you and that project.
Yeah. You were on Beyond Good a couple of years ago. That's a podcast I ran with a friend of mine, a guy called Matt Finley. We're just two mates who worked together in a school a few years back and spent a lot of time talking about maths teaching, what works, what doesn't work, and decided to just do it with microphones on. So yeah, you came on and I remember having a really interesting conversation with you about schools in America, what's going on over there. I remember your view was very much that it's a bit behind the UK in terms of understanding how children learn. Direct instruction, explicit instruction, that sort of thing, coaching, teacher development. So it was a really, really interesting discussion. But yeah, Beyond Good is basically two friends who are very passionate about education, just talking about it. And it's onto its 132nd episode and still going. We very much enjoy making it.
Well, we've had some fantastic math teachers on this podcast recently. We had Denarius Frazier has been on the podcast.
Yeah, I saw that one. Yeah, the legend. I read about him a lot in TLAC. So yeah, is that out yet?
It will be, but when people listen to this, it will be. Yeah.
Right. Great. Yeah, I'll have listened by now then, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's this podcast has really emphasized math because, if you had to say the UK is a little bit ahead of the US in stuff, it certainly is of all the subjects, I feel like that we're the most constructivist leaning. It is math. It is the right one that really hasn't. We understand early reading. I think we understand that kids that struggle with behavior need to be explicitly taught how to behave. But really, really math's lagging behind. Do you have a theory or why people see math differently sometimes than other subjects, treat it so differently?
Something to do with it is the idea that often people who are involved in maths education may well have been people who are in the top, let's say, decile in terms of their natural mathematical ability and sort of don't always understand what it is like for children to learn who are not there. That's something that I've very much noticed, in that, you know, I loved math. I was in the top set and I used to love doing these problems and these questions and talking through with my friends. So that's how my math lessons are going to be. And it's like, well, that's great that you had that experience as a young person, but it won't necessarily be the best way for little Jimmy in a middle ability class or who doesn't really like math to learn, you know?
I don't know. It seems like it's because so many people struggle in it, we just have this cultural view of math that makes it so it has to be revolutionized and rethought, and we need to, you know, raise consciousness about sort of math trauma. It's very strange to me.
The other thing I think, and I think it was Matt, my podcast colleague, who made this point the other day, is that watching effective learning take place in the math classroom, or any classroom, but I think especially math, just isn't very sexy to look at. You know, watching 25 kids with their heads down working hard, and Denarius Frazier or me or you, or whoever it might be, just circulating the room and having high quality conversations with pupils about what they're doing quietly while the rest of the pupils think hard, just doesn't look great. And so I think there's probably a group of people who have made a bit of a name for themselves, or have got to a certain stage through just doing something that looks a lot better than that, but actually isn't.
I think you're right. Well, let's get into some questions, because I loved how you kind of pitched me the questions, and I thought it was like perfect how it was. It was like out of the box. So you wanted to say, like, basically, like, let's start with how to begin a math lesson, how not to begin a math lesson. I'm very curious about this.
I'm really proud of the fact that the research points towards what the people that trained me were doing 20 years ago. Because I went through sort of 8-9 years, and Matt the same, of really having to fight against this a lot in our careers, because it just wasn't what people were doing. But then, you know, Rosenshine came out and other things, and it became a lot more common to talk about this. But I just can't see past an effective start being high-quality retrieval questions on things you've done before, just to, and we now know a lot more about why this works and how it works, but just to pull things from your long-term memory into your working memory and get the opportunity to practice things you've learned previously. I'm a big sports fan. I know it's not big in America, but we like rugby over here. And every rugby session, from under sevens through to professional rugby, will start with a bit of passing the ball, a bit of running around. Let's get warm. Let's get the hands moving. Let's do some little kicks. Let's do some little drills, all this sort of thing. And it's for exactly the same reason. It's just going back, putting this from our long-term memory into our working memory. And I really am a firm believer that should be done independently, that there should be a culture in the classroom of kids walking in and just getting on with those. And that's harder to achieve than it sounds.
You're describing basically some form of an entry task or a do now. There are debates that happen online between very good schools. The person and educators, the person I'm thinking of is Barry Smith. I think he won't mind if I name him on the podcast, who basically argues for an immediate start to the lesson and don't start with the do now. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my first thought on that is I would class Barry as a friend. You know, I've had him on the podcast a couple of times. He's an incredible guy. For anyone that's interested, we did an episode once where we actually deconstructed one of his lessons, like not minute by minute, but not far off it. And this is a reasonably tough school, a class that he'd taken over, sort of 13, 14 year olds. And his teaching of French in this class was absolutely fantastic. So a great teacher. We do disagree with him, though, about starts to lessons. He doesn't agree with written starters. I don't know whether something to do with that is that he is a language teacher, and really and truly, why would someone bother learning French? Well, maybe because you're a translator or you want to better write a letter to your girlfriend in French or whatever, but generally speaking, it's so that you can go to France and speak to the French people, right? And so there is probably something in what he does, and if anyone doesn't know what he does, he gets them straight into the room and he begins with some just, you know, saying something in English, they repeat back in French. Saying something more complicated in English, they repeat it back in French. Saying something even more complicated in English, you know, something like, I went to the shop and then I went to my mum's house and I bought a cup of tea, and they repeat that back in English, in French. And it is very, very impressive to see. I just am not too sure that it lends itself to the teaching of maths that well. He's talked about, could it be times tables and that sort of thing? It could be, but actually, generally speaking, I want my children doing multi-stage written problems that they will do at slightly different paces because their brains will work at slightly different speeds. And so I think, and I'm a firm believer in coming in paper and pen, and let's do some of these activities independently with teacher circulation. But I'd never say too much against Barry, because he is an absolute expert practitioner.
Absolutely. I mean, so it kind of brings us to, I mean, there's a lot of logistical reasons, I think, for the do now. You have to take roll or attendance. You have to start in a calm way. A lot of hallways like are not as calm as people as they should be. So kids come in and they're just sort of bringing in a lot of baggage from the outside. Maybe they had a teacher before them that sort of laid into them, reprimanded them. They're bringing something into the classroom. You gotta reset them. How do you not? I'm curious about the second part of this question. How do you not begin a math lesson? Like, what would be an example of a way that doesn't take advantage of some of these affordances you mentioned?
I mean, probably the way that you don't begin a math lesson is the way that all of my math lessons began as a pupil back in the 90s, which was, and you can probably picture it, teacher in her chair, someone goes around and gives out the textbook, someone goes around and gives out the exercise book, someone shouts, "It's too hot in here, miss, can we open the window?" Someone shouts, "It's too cold in here, miss, can I close the window?" Someone goes out because their friend walks down the corridor, "I've just got to go and see miss about today's football match, can I go have a quick, yeah, back in a minute." In and out, and a lot goes on before the first thought about maths takes place. And one of the things that we've talked about a lot in my school, where I lead on teaching and learning, is I call it reducing the background noise. So actually, if you can imagine a straight line going forward, often what the kids want to do, until you train them otherwise, is take you off that straight path in another direction. And some of their, "Can I open the window? Can I close the window? Miss, I've done my homework. Miss, was there actually homework? Miss, your dress looks nice. Miss, I've got a football match tonight." Is their quest to take you off the path that you want to go. But they don't all want to do that. And actually, I see it as my job to do what my mentor, who trained me, used to call protect the class. And there will be a lot of people in that class who actually do want to get down to it and learn something. So what I'm trying to do is create an environment where I can protect you guys and give everyone the opportunity for a settled class. So to answer your question, what shouldn't be happening is basically anything that isn't thinking about the starter activity. And I would include calling the register in that. We've had some quite animated discussions around this in my school. I'm a firm believer in the fact that if you know the class, and if you know the seating plan, if you have a seating plan, then why do we need to do all this? Zach, yes, miss. Lewis, yes, ma'am. Just there's just I know you guys. Like you always sit in the same seats, and I know all your names. And you all walked past me at the threshold at the start of the lesson, or they should have done. So why on earth do we have to have this silly performance of me shouting out your name and you saying yes, sir, when I could just get that done? So I'm a firm believer in silent register. Get that done, get away from your laptop and get out and experience the learning and circulate the room.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the do now lends itself to that, I mean, it's like it. You can look while everyone's silent at your seating plan, and you can just match up students are there or not. You got a couple that are not. You just put your X in, and then active circulation. I mean, get the clipboard out. Let's look. Let's observe. Let's collect data.
I mean, my general method of doing the register when I know a class reasonably well, I've got about 30 seats in my classroom, and most of my classes are reasonably full. So my first scan is anyone sat in the seat they should not be sat in? And my eyes are pretty good at just scanning across the room and no, everyone is sat where they should be sat. Okay, next, which seats are empty? That one and that one. Who sits in those seats? Zach and Matt. So they're not here. Right, let's go into the register. Done. Yeah, it's pretty standard, I think.
I'm curious, like you get the lesson started like sort of right away because everybody's doing their reps to start off. Do you spend a lot of time, or how much time do you spend actually like correcting the answers?
So there was a time, i.e., nearly a decade, when I would go back to the board and I would very much do this big performance of kind of, "Zach, you kick us off. Question one." "Okay, question one, sir. I found a common denominator and then I multiplied the." And I would go through every single question like that. And I don't think that's the end of the world. Like, as long as they're paying attention, as long as they're correcting their work, that's okay. I have now adjusted that slightly, and I very much try to use a Lomov term, hunting, not fishing. So I will go around the room now and I will make a pretty quick call. Where are we with this work? Okay, there were five or six questions. I'm pretty happy that questions 1, 2, 3, 4 were all done reasonably well. 5 is a complete mess. And 6, I think they just need to know one little thing. And if they did that, that would open up their thinking on this question. So I then would be going back to the board and getting the answers to those first 4 up pretty quickly. Okay, eyes on the board. Everyone look at the board, please. Right, I was pretty happy with question 1 and 4. A few little problems, but here we go. I'll go through them very quickly. Right, question 5. This caused problems. I now want everyone focusing on me, looking at the board, because this was not very well done. And then I will make a big deal out of that one question. What I'm not doing is making a big deal out of all of it. I do think there's something in cold calling and making students accountable that they will have to give their full answers to questions. Because one thing I have noticed a little bit doing observations sometimes in my school or other schools I visited is that it can become a little bit like, right, okay, so that's that done. Here are the answers. Tick across, tick across, tick across. Okay, and next. And it's like, why they don't. Do you want to believe there's a point to this? Because if all you're doing is saying there are the answers, tick across, why can't I just go to sleep? You know, and on the whole, they don't, because they do on the whole want to do well. But I think there is something in a kid taking pride in saying, Zach, I was really impressed with your answer to question 2. Can you just talk us through that step by step? Oh yeah, I drew a grid, and I did x times 2x, and I know that's 2x squared, and then I did. That there's something in that. It's quite special for them sometimes, and that shouldn't go all together.
Absolutely. I think that sometimes people talk about cold calling like it's only about including students who don't, who don't respond. And I'm like, I still think there's something to just this expectation that everybody is always called upon. Everything matters. Everything we do counts towards something, and I think if you can do it without kind of making the rest of the lesson turn into basically a the do now, the do now takes over the lesson. I think you can. So tell me about when you get to delivering the real lesson. I'm curious, does your school have some sort of like, do you have like a booklet type system? Do you have things prepared, or are you really planning lessons from scratch? You've never told me this, so I'm interested.
We are planning lessons from scratch, but I actually am in talks with the head of department right now about moving towards booklets. Because one thing that I have realized is that some members of staff, and this isn't exclusive to my school, and I was in two other maths departments this week, and it was the same there. Once you add in the added layer of having to think about the questions that they're going to choose, and then you add in the fact that explaining isn't always easy to some people, and then you add in the fact that holding the attention of pupils isn't always easy, those things kind of multiply on each other. So actually, is there a role for moving towards booklets and removing that and saying, look, we're gonna tell you what the examples are to use when you're teaching adding fractions to a class that haven't done it before, because I know what they are and they're these. So that what you can then do is use your, well, two things. Firstly, you can deliver those examples knowing that they're the right examples, because so often you watch a teacher deliver something and you're thinking, oh, brilliant, that's going to come out as a negative, and that's not what you wanted because you haven't thought this through. A half takeaway 5/8, it's not going to be, and they haven't quite got there. But actually, if we remove that, then I think my current thinking is that what might be able to happen is that those teachers can spend more time thinking about the delivery. And certainly, I know you've come across like Pritesh Raychura, and I've been to his school, ArcZone, and that's very much what they're doing. And I think that's probably the direction I'm going in now.
Yeah, it's interesting when you think about like then that causes all these other problems too, right? Like people not preparing for lessons, people thinking that the booklet will teach the lesson for them, and then they get to the end of the booklet and go, oh, great, I didn't scaffold enough for the questions that are in the booklet. There's no real easy answer, but I'm definitely on the side of lesson preparation over the planning. I don't know. So what do you do when you plan out then the lesson? Like what's your process and what does it end up looking like?
Well, the thing that I've discovered leading on teaching and learning in the school that I work in is that actually there's a lot that I take for granted, and there's a lot that I probably go very hard on in the first few weeks, get sorted, and then don't have to really do any more. And that's really helped me to understand like where lessons aren't going that well, maybe for colleagues. So one thing I go very hard on in the early weeks when I'm first teaching a new class is what I recently started calling the readiness routine. Explaining to the pupils what they are going to do for the next few minutes and what I am going to do for the next few minutes, and being really, really like, you know, dog with a bone on that and making sure that it happens. Because if you get that right, then later on you aren't going to have to do that. So you'll probably come across Adam Boxer, who's quite big over in the UK. And he talks about in the vast majority of lessons that I see, not in his school, but in schools he visited, the kids just aren't even listening. So actually, let's just forget it, because they're not actually listening to you. So it's definitely at the start of the year, a readiness routine, being really clear with the pupils. Right, okay, pens down, eyes on the board. I am now going to go through three or four examples of this new topic that you don't know. Nobody's going to interrupt me. And then after I've gone through those examples, you should be able to do this and you're going to have a go at some. And then really scanning the room and making sure that that happens while I'm teaching. That's really important. But what I've also learned watching videos of myself or Pritesh or Matt or whatever is how much Matt talks a lot about the CPU, you know, the computer in your brain can only be devoting 20% of its capacity to the teaching, while the other 80% scans the room, makes sure they're paying attention. But actually, for less effective teachers, a lot of it is taken up just getting it onto the board, getting it onto the iPad, whatever it is they're working. And that then means that people can spot that. And it's like, she's teaching solving equations, but she's not really. She's just solving equations.
Yeah.
And that means that I can do whatever I want. So certainly for me, it is being really clear with the pupils about what's going to happen. I'm a firm believer in pens down, eyes on the board, don't need to be doing anything other than looking at the expert. And then I am explaining this new concept myself without interruption, but I'm also scanning the room and making sure that the class are following me. And again, that is harder than it probably looks.
Well, yeah, I mean, some teachers are kind of scared of the kids, you know, they're kind of scared of making that eye contact and involving them, listening to their nonverbals, listening to the responding to behavior, or they can kind of, you know, let's just like, you know, kind of let it go, maybe ignore this for now and see if it goes away. You're just kind of following through, making sure that this is happening, using your whole body. Are you using the visualizer or the document camera?
Yeah, so actually I actually don't use that, although they're very good. I write directly onto my iPad with an Apple Pencil, and that then is connected to the screen. So everything I write is going straight up in real time. So it's the same as using a visualizer, but it's definitely live modeling in real time, no PowerPoint, writing directly onto the screen, thinking aloud. And what I talk about a lot is going through the same process that the kids are about to go through, you know?
Yeah, so there's a few questions I have here, because there's some debates around this, and maybe it's just that you do some things at different times, but there's one version where you model this out loud and you don't want to interrupt yourself. You don't want to self-interrupt. You don't want to have the kids respond. You don't want them to say anything, because it's going to interrupt the linkage of the ideas in the model.
Yeah.
There's another version where you're basically checking for listening at every interval to make sure that they're paying attention to the parts. I'm curious, do you see yourself using elements of either of those strategies?
The culture that I very much create is you will be listening, because in a minute you're going to be doing this. And it'll be very obvious to me, those of you that aren't doing it. And actually what I will also do, and it clearly doesn't work if it's half the class, but if in those early weeks I've got two or three people that just can't do it because they weren't listening, I make a point of that. And I actually just leave them. So I will do something like, I'll teach solving equations, three examples. Right, okay, now here's five for you to do. Off you go. Stay at the front, customers perch, get them all settled in independently working, then circulate. And if I've got one guy at the back who's just like, oh, so I don't have a clue on this. It's like, I know you don't. And I'll tell you how I know you don't. Because you weren't listening to anything I was saying when I was teaching. And actually, I'm not against that. And that could be the biggest driver for some kids, feeling like they're a bit out on a limb. Like, oh, okay, they can't. Ah, I can't. That's actually quite important. The other thing that I do, and I guess this is more of your checking for listening thing, and I was talking to someone about this the other day, is What could be very effective is inserting children's names into your explanations as you teach to make the point that you are noticing people who are wandering in terms of attention. And I didn't even know I did this actually, but I was doing it as a model for someone the other day. So I'll give you a little demo. It'll be something like saying, okay, so we've got 2x plus 3 equals 7. I'm going to minus 3 from both sides. Zach, you're not listening. Eyes on me, please. 2x equals 4. I'm then dividing by 4 by 2, and I've got an answer of x equals 2. And I know it's Zach, it still isn't looking at the board. You need to be on the next example, please. Right, question 3. Let's have a look at this one. So, and it's just not breaking the flow, but also it's saying, I am watching very carefully. And the reason why I remembered that I do a lot of this is I was watching a teacher the other day, and theirs was more like this. Okay, so we've got 2x plus 3 equals 7. We're going to mark year 7. This isn't good enough. This isn't good enough at all. You're not looking at the board, and you should be. Okay, we're going to minus 3 from both. So still not looking. Still, this is not good enough. You're not going to do this if you don't listen. Okay, so we've got 2x equals 4. Oh, I am not going to. And I remember watching saying, it is very, very hard to follow a new process that you don't know if it keeps getting interrupted for 3 to 5 seconds with a big tell off and a big, And so actually, dropping it in there from time to time as part of the flow does help people, just does help it just carry on. And then you can kind of say, look, I'm not dropping my flow here, but I have noticed. But again, it's not easy stuff.
Yeah, that long self-interrupt, and then you do it a few times and you go, fine, great. Then
Yeah.
you're just like, now you've created the situation where there's just this conflict, this battle you've created.
Yeah. Yeah.
But quick, lightning fast sort of redirections. It reminds me of like least invasive intervention,
Yeah.
like kind of the Doug
Yeah.
Lamov style. So what do you do when you sort of you said you have like three or four models, three or four problems you go through. Is there a strategy to how you sort of select those? Do they kind of go in the order of what would be sort of simplest to hardest, or are they all the same? I'm curious about this.
Yeah, I kind of would say that my first one is always like what I would call the settler. It's the he's done this big chat about how we're doing this big new topic called Pythagoras. I'm a little bit scared by that because what on earth is this? But he's done example one and it was actually fine. And that's how you want them to feel. Like as long as you get this lovely bit of feedback from them when they just kind of nod, it's like that was okay, and you're like good, and you know what's coming. We're now going to go a little bit deeper into two and three, but you do want them to kind of settle in one and feel just happy with it. And you can go either way with that. So you'll see teachers who will just do something ridiculous on the first one. Like they're trying to do area of a triangle using trigonometry, but in their example one is like a little triangle where all the sides are five. It's like, and we do know how to do, sorry, like perimeter of a triangle, let's say, and all the sides of, we do know how to do this, don't we? Because we 5 plus 5 plus 5 is 15. And then you can get this kind of eye roll of this woman thinks we're stupid. What on earth is it? And you don't want that, but you also don't want launch into the hardest thing and straight away you get that horrible, what? Huh? Do you get this? No. Do you get this? No. Because that's also a bad sign. So you want to be in the middle somewhere with a nice little settler. Where it does teach new content, but it doesn't blow people's minds. But of course, none of this goes anywhere if they're not listening.
I've been sort of obsessed more than with like the extraneous load of like a model, but just like the fact that the model itself can just the problems itself just have too much of a cognitive demand. There's a lot of like think about like the division algorithm you teach like fourth graders.
Yeah.
You're just like you see that this is the expectation that they need to be able to solve problems like this. So you stand up in front of the students and you say, so watch me do this first one, and you're already lost because there's just too much, right? And I'm curious, like, do you prepare sort of like partial models, like ice, like atomized models, and sort of build up from there, you know?
I don't know what the atomized stuff means. Someone was talking to me about that today, actually. I don't really know what it is. But I just prepare a couple of examples that are ready to go on my iPad that I can then just do the first one and scroll down, and the second one's there. into the film. I don't want to have to be like drawing it out in front of them because that wastes a bit of time. And I just like, I would describe it as like you're telling a little bit of a story. You know, I know you've got kids. You're sitting on the edge of your kid's bed and you go, I can tell you a little story. I can tell you a little story. You know, there was a wolf and the wolf lived in a big house. And the big house was made of like marshmallows, and the kid's like, oh, this is a cool story. I can't wait to find out what's next. And you kind of want that to be your lessons. Like there was a triangle, and this triangle had an unknown side, and we find it like this. Oh, that's kind of cool. That's cool. I think I could do that. And then you go into your next one and your next one. And I tend to sort of, and I don't make any apologies about this. I was talking to someone about this today. I tend to overteach a little bit, and I often get to a situation where probably most of you could do this after example two, but I am actually going to do an example three because I want 100% to be able to do it when I release you. Because the one thing I hate, and I know maybe we're going to come on to this, is what is not good in the math lesson is a teacher then having to go around the room and reteach because that's wasted time. So I probably do go a little bit beyond where some need it, but that's because when I release you, I want everyone to be able to do this.
It's interesting you bring up the storytelling kind of stance or mode of teaching math, because often people read the chapter I wrote about storytelling and they go,
Right.
well, that only applies to history. And
Oh no.
the examples you gave were only really like humanities kind of lessons. And I go, well, I should have said what you just said, basically.
Do you have the calculators in the US that leave things in natural form? Like if you push root eight, it would say 2 root 2. Is that what you use?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. So all of our calculators do that. And I've got a set way that I will teach like thirds. To like year, well, whatever year I'm doing. I did it the other day, and I'll sort of say, okay, so we've got a square. The area of the square is 36. So we know, don't we, that the sides of that square are 6, because 6 times 6 is 36. Better way of saying that, square root of 36 is. And you can see that, oh, yeah, that's fine, fine. Okay, now I've got another square where the area is 8. Okay, so we're going to square root the sides. Now I could do that on my calculator, and the square root of 8 is 2 point blah, 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 blah. I don't want to put that, so I'm going to put root 8. And actually, there's a way of simplifying that root 8. I'll then show them what that is. And then we've got 2 root 2. And that's what your calculator is doing when it gives you that. Now, and you can see them being like, this is as cool as it's ever going to get. Like, I'm not going to go home and tell my dad about this. Like, I'd much rather be on my phone in bed, right? Like most teenagers or me. But that's all right. And I'll tell you actually the king of this. The absolute gold medal king that puts me to shame on this. Have you heard of Eddie Wu?
Yeah, that's right. I have.
That guy is the master storyteller, and he just lets maths tell the story. And I never know with him whether he actually ever does end up getting the kids doing any like independent practice, because he seems to just be a bit of a storyteller, but maybe he does. But watching him teach like what was it? I was watching him do something the other day, and it's just beautiful. His ability to take me from what I know to what I definitely know I didn't know is masterful.
Yeah, it's something I need to emphasize more. I think it's a stance, it's a mode of explanation that just that embeds narrativity. You know, it's something about like I talk about how people said everybody should, this teacher should be more engaging, blah blah blah, and it's a way of like gaslighting
Yeah.
teachers. But it's really I think that that's what it comes down to is that this is a person who's looking at us and scanning the room and telling something in a way that just sort of one thing unfolds logically after another, and they're using
Yeah.
gestures, and it's just a way of masterful, teacher expression. I think it's awesome.
The engaging line is hard, isn't it? Because there definitely are people who make things sound more interesting than other people.
Yeah.
And it's hard to kind of quantify that. It's hard to have a, like a step lab step on that. But there is, I've seen like first day ECT trainee teachers who make solving equations sound more interesting than the guy who's been doing it for 40 years. And I don't know how you teach that.
Well, I'm curious about this question you have in here for me. The transformative method of giving people answers as well as questions when tackling math problems. What do you what do you mean by this?
So what I mean by this is that I was taught maths back in the day like this. Okay, this is how you solve equations. I'll do two on the board. You'll sit quietly while I do two on the board. Thank you. Okay, here's a dusty old textbook. You'll work through them. And then with about 10 minutes to go, I will call the answers out. So question one, X was 4. Tick it or cross it. Question two, X was 6. Tick it or cross it. And the teacher would call out the answers and we tick, tick, tick. Ah, oh, cross, 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 cross. Okay, now you can go and have your lunch. And then when I got to like A level, which is just before what you guys would call college, we started to use textbooks that had answers in the back. And the teacher would just say, work through the exercise. This would obviously be quite a lot more advanced than like general school maths. But as you go, flip to the back and make sure you're getting them right. So you solve like a hard equation and you think the answer was X equals a third. You flip to the back of the book, you check question 4B, exercise 4B, question 2, X equals a third. Yes, it is. Yes, good, got it right. Okay, now I'll do the next one. And you get this little, what Matt calls the dopamine hit of, I can do this, I'm getting it right. Brilliant, next one. And when I got to teaching younger kids, like secondary school, age 11 upwards, I just thought, why can't we have that every lesson? Why can't I give them the solutions as well as the problems so that they can mark their work in real time and know if they're getting it right? Now, there's a couple of caveats to that. You can't do it with work that basically has no stages of working. So if it was like directed numbers, you're trying to work out like -2, -3, the answer is -5. We can't have the answers right next to it because you can't tell whether the kids are just copying the answers or not. But if it's something that takes some working out, like, for example, I was watching a lesson today, which was surface area of a cylinder, of a cuboid. I can tell very obviously whether you're cheating because I've asked you in my modelling to draw out the sides of the cuboid, work out all the areas of all the rectangles and squares, and then at the end, add them up and then get a final answer and give your answer in centimetres squared. So if you haven't done that, you are cheating because obviously you've just written 444 centimetres squared and then ticked it. So that concept of giving them the answers as well, maybe on the back, and just saying, do these questions, work through them, show your full workings, like I did when I went through them on the board, but then mark it as well. And I'm here to help if you've got one wrong, rather than I'm going to run around the room with a red pen ticking it all. If done well, they love it. They absolutely love it. And it makes a huge difference.
I think about the ways that students would like game it and cheat, basically. Like you think about, I divide help seekers into help users, students into two categories. There's ones that sort of abuse the help. They basically use it to kind of like just get through it without having to do any thinking. And then there's the type of student who doesn't use it very effectively at all, or avoids using it, kind of a help avoider. I mean, how do you address students who in this mode, because I think it could be very effective, when they're in this mode of learning, how do you get them to take on, you know, good scholarly, like academic behaviors while they're doing this?
Think about a five-year-old child, right? A five-year-old child says, Dad, I think I could jump from that sofa to that sofa without touching the floor. And you go, I don't think you can. What the five-year-old child will probably not do is say, hey, Dad, look out the window. And then when you look out the window, just run on the floor and jump onto the other sofa. He wants to do it. He wants to show you, I can do this. I'm good enough. So in my experience, they don't really cheat unless they haven't got a clue what they're doing. They want to do it. They want to get things right. They want to be clever. So when you do go into a classroom, and I have seen classrooms like this where the teacher's trying this and they're just writing down the answer and ticking it or just copying the answers, it's normally because they don't know how to do it or because it hasn't been really clearly explained to them how this is going to work and why it's going to work like this. So the first time that I do this with a class, I go big on explaining to them how it's going to work. I'll say something like, right, okay, you've just solved 4 equations. I've checked you can do it. You were absolutely brilliant. We're now at the bit where you practice it, because we all know that you have to practice things to get good at them. I want you to work through these 30 questions, and I want you to do 2 at a time and then check your answers. Please do not do it without showing your full working. Please do not just copy down the answers. I will know because there'll be no working out. In an exam, and we all know that we're heading towards exams here, You're going to have to do this on your own. And that's what this is all about. Go. And they just, they do it. They don't really, why would they, you know, every now and then you'll get somebody who hashtags the 7, 2, and 8. And you'll say, oh, I see here you've put 7, but actually it's 8. How did you? You cheated, didn't you? Oh, yeah, I couldn't work that one out, sir. Come on, ask me then. Put your hand up. Yeah. But on the whole, they will do it. And don't forget, you're circulating, you're getting around the room, you're checking on everyone every couple of minutes, you're watching them do it, you're looking over shoulders, and they do it.
That's awesome. I'm curious because you have the role of coach at your school, and you're, so are you also the head of math?
No, so I've been head of maths in 2 different schools, but I've now got a what we call in the UK a whole school role. I'm in charge of teaching and learning for the whole school. So there is a head of maths as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and so you have the opportunity to observe lots of math lessons. I mean, how is that impacted, first of all, your view on like what type of math teaching is scalable or most effective?
It certainly helped me get better. It's done 2 things. The first is it's made me a lot less surprised at things I see in the classroom. So I was very lucky in the early part of my career. I had some very, very effective math teachers around me who watched me teach a lot and I watched them teach a lot. And then I went to a new school and saw some teaching which just wasn't very good and was just in a state of shock. And actually, I let myself down a bit by being a bit like, why are you doing this? Why is this rubbish? And all that. And now I'm just far less surprised by things I see. So if, for example, a teacher says to me, I don't think giving a kid's answers has got any legs at all, that will never work. Like, I'm not surprised when I hear that. So it's helped me understand what teachers often say. The other thing it's helped me do is help me often put a word to or notice what it is that needs to be worked on. So, for example, what I talked to you before about the readiness routine, that's something that I wouldn't have spoken about a year ago, but I've now recognised that the reason why a lot of direct instruction is not effective in the classroom is teachers don't tell kids what they need to do and what the teacher will do in the next couple of minutes. So there's this kind of expectation that you will look at the board, listen to me and learn, but I haven't actually told you that's what you need to do. And I've now started being able to identify this stuff better and think about how to fix it quicker than I used to before.
There's this thing I can't really put to words or say because it's not really a tweetable thing, but it's this feeling that I have that I've learned more about teaching in the past few years of basically not having my own classroom than I did during the latter part of being a full-time teacher. And the reason why is because you, as a second set of eyes, and also just the sheer volume of lessons that I observe, you just start seeing patterns and developing like archetypes, and you can predict teaching better. And of course, that doesn't really satisfy folks that are in the classroom thinking, oh, you left the classroom and now you know more than us. Like, but I'm like, I swear that element of it is very, very true. The more lessons I've seen, the more I've developed an understanding of other people's teaching and so on.
I've probably got one advantage over you on that, in that I'm still teaching, of course.
Yeah.
Because being an assistant head teaching learning, you would still, I've got about 40% of lessons across the week I teach. And the other 60 I don't. So that then means that I am still in the classroom. And I'm then reminding myself of why are they doing this here, but they don't know. Okay, it's because of this. So it means you kind of do the two at the same time.
And this model, I've talked about it before on this podcast, this model of teachers, head teachers, assistant heads, and so on, still having a teaching load is so attractive to me. There are zero schools that have that model here. Like, I've never seen it. I've never seen it once, you know. What does it do is you have this idea and you want to tell everyone about it, but you know what? I'm just going to test it out real quick before I start telling other people to do it.
It certainly means that no teacher can say, yeah, but you don't understand, or it's changed since your time, or you don't understand. One thing we used to have quite a lot of, not so much now, was we were talking a lot about the starts of lessons. And teachers might say, Yeah, but if you've got a class and then you've got another class straight after, as in like, you know, one finishes at 11 and the next one starts at 11, which we have in most schools in the UK, it's very hard to the second lesson to start as you're asking for. But I have that on Tuesday. So people can't say that. And also, like, I still enjoy it. Like, there's nothing better than being amongst a group of kids teaching the math. That's a great, I still get a lot out of that. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I think of this this school I've been working with where we sort of made the times, we sort of micro scheduled it a little bit more. Before it was like everybody kind of decides what when they teach and what they teach, and we kind of were like, the due now has got to be this long. Let's make sure that literacy lasts this long, you know, and so on. And then we get a lot of like backlash from a certain percentage of the staff going, it's just too much. You've crammed in too much into the schedule. And I just think if I was teaching this, I could proof of concept, like, no, it's not, you know, or I can refine it and bring it back, but I don't really have the ability to do that. I just sort of have to take people at their word, you know.
In the UK, a head teacher may not teach, but that's all you'd get would be the very, very the big boss. But even there, you sometimes do. I was in a school today where the head teacher teaches, I mean, she was teaching history like this afternoon. Still happens.
So from those lessons in working in a coaching capacity, like what have you learned in terms of running a math department, developing a group of people collectively? Like what are some of the main lessons here?
Yeah, so my understanding of coaching is still developing a lot. I believe you've had like Josh Goodridge on the pod, and I see him as being an absolute legend of this. Just the way he talks about coaching, I've seen him coach. Matt, who's my podcast co-host, works quite closely with Josh, so knows him very well. And I really want to be like where he is, because in the same way that you could give me like a problem in the classroom, so you could say, okay, Femi, what happens when you're mid-explanation and a kid looks out the window and a bird flies past and they start laughing? What would you do then? I could like go to a bank of similar situations I've dealt with and think, okay, I can select my answer from my experience. I want that with coaching. And I think Josh has got that with coaching. And I think it's one of the reasons why StepLab is so good, in that he has road tested that this for like a long time. Before saying, oh, this will work, he said, let's check this works. And I can remember on the Step Lab actually, some of the very early training videos they put out, he was like a deputy head in his school, like in his office, recording like training stuff for Step Lab. So he really was right in the middle of it as a main scale teacher. And that's what I want from my coaching. So I've learned a lot about it. I now 100% do believe in incremental coaching and just picking one thing that we're going to work on, exactly like you with a pupil. You go over to your friend's son's house because they need math tuition for their exams, and they've got their mock paper, and they say, oh, I need help. I got 12% in my mock. I need your help. You don't say, well, let's just go through the whole of maths now. Okay, that's not. And then you say, okay, right, okay, I'm noticing here that you haven't really got a very secure understanding of directed numbers like positives and negatives. We've got to crack that, because that underpins a lot of the algebra you'll need to do, a lot of the number work you'll need to do. So let's work on that today. That is exactly what you need to do with teachers who are developing, but people don't. They go in there with a notepad and write 14 pages of developmental points. Say, why don't you try this? Why don't you try this? What I do is this, and that's what I used to do, very much what I used to do. And now I really do believe in scaling that down to, okay, at the moment, we're working on you having a really clear readiness routine so that pupils know how they're supposed to behave when you're teaching, and you communicate with them what you're going to do when they're teaching. And that's what we're going to nail this week. And that's it. I really do see that as being the way forward. It's hard though, because I make two mistakes. The two mistakes I make are not being able to pull out a step which is robust enough, and it's probably not the right one. And the other mistake I make is just giving a step that's too big. I sometimes basically say, so Zach, I'm coaching you. Your step is basically to be able to get the class into the room, settle, teach them some maths, circulate the room, make sure they're doing it, and then dismiss them at the end of the lesson. That's your step for this week. And it's like, it's just too much. And I'm still making that mistake now sometimes. So I'm learning this.
Maybe you don't have this problem in your context as much as I've experienced, because I'm all over different schools, and some of the schools are so much looser than other ones, right? They just have so few resources for teachers or so few expectations. I've been to lessons in which I thought, look, you went on Teachers Paid Teachers or something and you printed something out and it was, you shouldn't have done that. The behavior was just such a mess. And the whole thing needs to be like, start, you know, basically reworked from the very bottom up, that I need to establish the conditions for you to teach. I feel like this is a hole in the coaching literature that I've really wanted to emphasize. What do you do when you've got that sort of situation on your hands?
Yeah, they're the hardest ones. And I think the reason why they're the hardest ones is you probably have to crack a lot of steps with that teacher before they will actually notice a definable difference to what's going on in their classroom. I was thinking about this yesterday, right? I don't know where you have this in America. I went to like the bottle bank. That's where you take your glasses and things that are used and you enter for recycling. Do you have that in America?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So in my left hand, I had this really heavy bag of bottles, glass bottles. And I started to take them out one by one and put them into the thing. And as I was putting them in, I was thinking, I've had to put quite a lot in before this like isn't heavy. do you know what I mean? And then there became this point when it was like, oh, now this is easy. Now this is just like popping them in, no problem at all. But the first seven or eight I put in with my right hand, my left hand was holding the bag, and it still just felt really heavy and kind of, it felt like I hadn't put anything in yet. And I feel like that's the same with lessons sometimes, is that, okay, we're going to get you to be on the threshold when the pupils enter. We're going to get you to be in pastor's perch. We're going to get you to scan the room as the class come in. We're going to get you to write a high quality do now. A lot of that can happen, but it's still bloody chaos. And so that teacher can give up quite early, as it's like, I'm doing this coaching, I'm here after school, it's 4:30, everyone else has gone home, I'm working with you, I like you, but I'm not noticing it being much different, so I'm going to just kind of give up. And that is the hardest challenge, I find. So I guess the only thing I've got on that really is, I have got a little bit better at articulating to the coachee what the journey is going to be. A bit like you have physio, got a really bad ankle, and you're having physio, and the physio says to you, look, I'm going to give you some exercises to do, and you're going to feel blooming stupid doing these in the mirror, and you're going to feel like nothing is changing, and you're going to feel like your ankle's never going to be worth walking on again. You're never going to have to run or play football with your kids. But do these every week, and a time will come when it just starts to strengthen, it just starts to get better. You'll be able to walk without a limp, and that is when you're going to really see the benefit of the work we've done. And actually, I think that a little bit of that is needed sometimes, because people often want like strategies. And if it was that easy, like, we would have just given these strategies out on day one and we wouldn't have these problems. But I know what you mean. It is hard.
I think that's it. It's explaining that journey. It's maybe writing it out, mapping it out with them, maybe on the whiteboard or something. You're just like, look at where it's going to go. And then these steps are going to accumulate. They're going to start to cluster and they're going to start to combine. But eventually you're going to start to feel that it's going somewhere. Maybe right at the beginning, it might seem a little small, like it's not going to fix everything. Yeah. But there are no quick fixes, right?
The other thing I think is important to say to some of these people is, what I'm doing now is giving you the tools that, when there's a combination of you getting these tools right and you having a new class in September, you will be able to get this and nail this. Because to a certain extent, you are going to find it hard to get these kids back now, because it is a long way gone. And if I took them for a term, I would struggle with some of the stuff in here now. But what I'm going to do is give you some raw materials, some core habits that combined with a class that haven't got bad habits will mean that you're off and running.
Because sometimes it's January, it's February. You're just like,
exactly. Yeah.
Femi, we've run out of time. I could talk to you for forever about these topics. Curious, anything else you have to share with us before we sign out?
No, not really. I just think For anyone who's interested in pedagogy and teaching, never underestimate the power of school visits and going into different contexts and seeing different teachers. I personally believe this is so much more powerful than some of the kind of big teaching and learning meetings, seminars, webinars that are out there. Just getting in and speaking with other people is really, really invaluable. So do that.
Awesome. Thank you, Femi. All right. And listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to Progressively Incorrect. Go ahead and give it a 5-star rating. Spread it around. Really appreciate you listening. Take care.
Yeah. Thank you very much.